From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Hurricane Dorian is battering the East Coast after it made landfall in the U.S. this morning on North Carolina's Outer Banks. Dorian struck Cape Hatteras as a Category 1 storm. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Jeff, what kind of damage is Dorian doing today in North Carolina?
Well, thankfully, the center of the storm is pushed offshore, so now we have, in most cases, an offshore flow. There's still some onshore winds and some beach erosion and even some minor surge occurring from Cape Hatteras north up to the Delmarva Peninsula, where tropical storm force winds are still possible right along the coast.
And what kind of rainfall came with this storm in North Carolina? I know there's always a concern about flooding.
Yeah, in most cases, 10 to 15 inches of rain fell on the western side of the track of that storm, some localized higher amounts, of course, and the flooding may linger for a while as the creeks and streams attempt to drain down into the ocean, and they, of course, they can't because the ocean levels rose, but still some ongoing flooding probably for the next couple of days.
Looking at the track of this storm, it appears to be moving both to the north and to the east, out towards the open water. Have we seen the worst of Dorian at this point?
I think in the Carolinas, yes. There will likely be some rough surf and some rip currents and certainly some high seas up and down the eastern seaboard. But I think the worst of Dorian is over in the United States. Of course, it could still cause some conditions to be rough on the coastline.
Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks as always.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
But the nightmare of Dorian is far from over in the Bahamas, where its damage has been catastrophic. Joining us now is Jason Neil Roberts. He's a resident of Sandy Point on Great Abaco Island. Jason, thank you for speaking with us. The island you live on was ravaged by this storm, but I see you writing on Facebook that your home was spared the brunt of Dorian's wrath. Is that right?
That is correct. We were spared the brunt of its wrath because we were in the tropical storm winds. But it is often said that storms of this magnitude, they carry tornadoes with them. My wife and I were going through a regular routine change of oil in our generator when we just heard horrific noises as if a 747 was about to take off. Hmm. And she started to complain about pressure being in her ears, and she didn't know why it was happening. And I just realized that, listen, we're about to be hit by a tornado. And I told her to run into the house, and as she ran and I ran behind, I screamed for everyone, including my mother-in-law and children, to come down the stairs as quick as possible. We were in the hallway, and about just like bombs were going off, like five bombs went off. And 10 seconds later, I went to the outside of my house, and it was like total savagery. Neighbors to the left, to the right, and to the front of me, their roofs were shredded. And one of my vehicles, it's in the front of my yard. It's like someone propelled a rocket into it. It was just mashed real bad.
But your family is safe?
My family is safe. And it's just dealing post-Dorian issues because persons who are from the disaster zone area, the island that was most severely hit, they're homeless now. And a lot of them are migrating this way. Because this is the only airport that is usable at the time, because the airport in Marshab, where the storm reaped some of the most severe damage, that is still not usable due to flooding. And this small town that hosts about 500 people, all of a sudden it grew to like 2,000 people. And so, we were faced with security issues, and the police were not ready because we have a small police unit here in this town. And so there were many different issues that we were faced and plagued with. I had to host about 50 persons at my church last night in the hall. We had to provide sheets and try to provide fooding for them. And, I was just being so sympathetic and apologetic that I could not do more. But they were so grateful and simply said, we're just so happy to have a roof above our head.
Well, and I understand that you are a Baptist minister. How is your faith holding up through all of this and the faith of the people who you shepherd?
Well, I always look at even the worst moments in life as an opportunity to have a teachable moment in it. And, for me, it's very humbling. And, I try to project the message through this is that, storms come and sometimes life becomes shredded. But, God is there with us. And, if your faith is intact, you'll make it stronger and better than you ever was.
And yet I've seen some of the pictures that you've taken from the island. The human toll is horrifying. You've seen it with your own eyes.
Oh, my Lord. The human toll is horrifying, and the death toll continues to rise. When the final toll is given, this is going to go down as one of probably the most horrific events, probably within our country's history and probably on this side of the hemisphere.
Jason Neil Roberts lives on Great Abaco Island, just absolutely devastated by Hurricane Dorian. Jason, thanks for your time, and best of luck to you and to your neighbors.
Thank you very much. God bless you.
Let's take a look at some of the other news going on today and how it's filtering through the lens of social media with Femi Okeh, who's host of the stream on Al Jazeera English and joins us each week. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Well, first of all, big news overnight, the death of Robert Mugabe, who was the former president of Zimbabwe and was forced to resign in 2017 after a military takeover. He was in power since the end of white minority rule in 1980, emerged as an African liberation hero, and then a man known for violent repression of political opponents and, of course, the economic ruin of Zimbabwe. How are people reacting to his death online?
If you look on social, it's almost like you're looking at two very different people. There's respect from heads of state and people really appreciate him as somebody who led the liberation of Zimbabwe and got rid of British colonial rule from Zimbabwe. So Samaki, for instance, says Africa has lost one of the greatest leaders, R.I.P. Mugabe. Lots of teasing pictures because Robert Mugabe always looked like an impressive figure. He dressed beautifully or he stood out. He had very striking outfits and striking hats. There's a picture of him asleep. This sums up some of the teasing that's going on online. Totally asleep. He's at an official event and then Trust the Journey posts on Twitter, the education system you had in place, indicating it wasn't very good. Asleep at the wheel. Some genuine delight that Mugabe is dead and also some story sharing. This one from Johan Norberg, who is a writer, and he remembers the time that there was a raffle. The Master of Ceremonies announced the prize. It was a huge prize. Zimbabwean, $100,000 was the prize. On the back of the ticket was written, His Excellency R.G. Mugabe. So it gives you an idea of how he maybe attained some of his great wealth, but very different viewpoints all over Twitter. So you get a really good sense of the complexity of this man.
When it comes to Hurricane Dorian on social media, I've actually noticed how little there has been coming out of the Bahamas, and probably because people do not have the communications tools right now to put things out online, videos. I just saw a video, maybe for the first time since the storm, of a dramatic boat rescue in the Bahamas, but these things are just starting to come out. One of the things that has been talked about online a lot since the storm is Sharpiegate, Femi, which is this is President Trump, who appeared to doctor that map with a Sharpie showing that Alabama could be affected by Hurricane Dorian, which was not the case. He refused to admit that he was wrong about it. And people have been tweeting using that hashtag Sharpiegate. What are some of the tweets you're seeing?
Well, this is the first time I've ever seen meteorologists jump online and be very, very angry about something that wasn't to do with a natural disaster. And they are chastising the president. Brian Larder, for instance, is a meteorologist and a journalist and taught a lot of us something, which is that isn't altering an official forecast map illegal? And then he puts a link onto how it could be illegal. And indeed, if you do change an official forecast, there is a penalty of 90 days in jail.
Okay.
I don't think that's going to happen. No. There's a whole backstory about how an aide was telling the president this is where it could have gone if it was going to Alabama. But the president continued to say over and over again in his tweets, Alabama is at risk. This is problematic when a silly story then becomes the main story and you're not really paying attention to a potentially deadly hurricane. But the first time I've seen meteorologists and weather forecasters basically punch back at the president. Because he was, even if he was doing it accidentally, giving out bad information, and there's no time for that.
One thing I want to ask you about before we let you go, singer-songwriter Lana Del Rey has a new album. This is part of her new song, Mariner's Apartment Complex.
You took my sadness out of context at the Mariner's Apartment Complex. I ain't no candle in the wind.
Now, NPR put a review online, and the writer, Ann Powers, called the lyrics in this work uncooked. And then Lana Del Rey responded and said, don't call yourself a fan like you did in the article, and don't count your editor one either. And she was told in the review that she was putting on a persona, and Lana Del Rey said that she's never had a persona, never needed one, never will. What do you make of this?
This has blown up, and the NPR critic Ann Powers is really well known. She's very beloved. Music critics have been rallying around her, saying this is the idea of what great music criticism is about. You take the review, it helps you grow as an artist, and then Lana Del Rey's fans are actually saying, you're just trying to get some attention. We know your authenticity, and they are basically punching back. So this has turned into a huge Twitter storm, and we did get in touch with NPR's music critic Amy Powers early on. She said she loves the music.
She stands by
the review.
We'll leave it there with Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're so welcome.
This week marks 80 years since the start of World War II. On September 1st, 1939, Hitler ordered his German military to invade Poland. Before the war ended in 1945, millions of Poles would die. Last Sunday, Poland marked the anniversary with somber ceremonies and air raid sirens like the ones that blared on that day 80 years ago. Joining us now to talk about Poland's role in the war is Roger Morehouse, author of the new book, First to Fight, The Polish War, 1939. He's at the BBC in London. Roger Morehouse, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
So, first of all, what happened on September 1st of 1939?
At dawn on September 1st, 1939, the Germans attacked Poland. An aged German battleship opened fire on the Polish port just outside Danzig in the north of to the north of Poland. And at the same time, a couple of strategic bridges were hit. And pretty soon after, the air raids started and the German troops started pouring over the border.
Was it a surprise attack?
The tensions had been rumbling for much of the summer, but the Poles had sort of done everything they could to shore up their position by finding foreign alliances with the British and the French, for example. And it had been hoped that that would stave off any sort of German attack. The Poles knew that they were, facing very hostile enemies, actually, on both sides, both the Germans and the Soviets on the other side. So they wouldn't have been, a tremendous surprise. They had their troops in place. It wasn't like a Pearl Harbor in that sense. But the timing certainly and the method of attack was rather shocking, not least because of the brutality that the Germans utilized right from the very outset.
What do you mean by that?
I think we tend to, I don't know how the American narrative of World War II goes, which is obviously rather different, given that for the Americans, the war starts very, very obviously in 1941. Mm-hmm. But the British narrative of World War II in Europe certainly is one where you could say that we sort of assume that there's this gradual development of this aspect of brutality and ideological warfare, which is something that sort of kicks in really after 1941 with the German invasion of the Soviet Union. But the experience of the September campaign, this invasion of Poland, actually shows us that that's ideologically fueled warfare and the very deliberate targeting of civilians is absolutely front center in 1939 as well. So almost every Polish town and village was affected with random massacres of civilians, massacres of POWs. It's a sort of universal experience in 1939, and that's one thing that I think I found quite shocking in when I was writing the book.
Did the Poles fight back?
Absolutely. The Poles again, the stereotype, which really goes back to essentially to Nazi propaganda of World War II, which tended to try and portray them as sort of foolish, incompetence on horseback, effectively. But the Polish army was actually rather good in general comparative terms to other armies at the time. It was about 1 million men. It had a good number of relatively modern aircraft and relatively modern tanks and so on. The main problem it had was that it was facing the Germans, who were the most sort of technologically advanced military machine on the planet at the time. But yes, they did have a sort of thought out plan, and they tried to resist as best they could. And there are some really quite spectacular and sort of bitter pitched battles in this campaign of 36 days. So they really did fight back. They fought very hard. Yes, absolutely.
Now, as we said, the German invasion of Poland happened on September 1st of 1939, but just days later, into September, the Soviets also invaded Poland.
Indeed. And this is something, again, I think the Western narrative, the English-speaking narrative, tends to forget. Stalin is effectively in cahoots with Hitler. He's not in a formal alliance, but he's in a cooperative arrangement, we could say, with Hitler. And this was the first expression of that common cause, was their effectively joint destruction of Poland. So the Red Army invades on the 17th of September. It dresses up its engagement as a sort of, you know, humanitarian operation or a police operation, you know, claiming that Poland had already collapsed and it was just going in to take care of, you know, Belarusian and Ukrainian minorities and so on. But that was really propaganda eyewash. The truth was that was very obviously a military operation, and I show that in the book. So it's an interesting chapter, really, that we, particularly in the English-speaking narrative, don't talk about as much as we should. So I hope I can try and change that.
Now, Poland was home, as we know, to concentration camps like Auschwitz, where many Jews died. Mm. But I just met the other day somebody whose grandparents, Catholics, were in Poland and were in camps during the war. How many people, Poles, Jews and otherwise, were put into concentration camps during the war?
Oh, millions. I mean, I think it's a misconception that concentration camps were just for Jews. You know, it's anyone that the Nazis considered was, you know, in any way suspect or someone undesirable, whether racially or politically, would be put into a concentration camp. The original concentration camps, incidentally, are not for Jews at all. And the same thing with Auschwitz. Even Auschwitz, when it's first established in 1940, is established as a concentration camp for Poles. And it only really evolves into that sort of function that we know so well, that hideous function of extermination later on in its life. So absolutely, there are huge numbers of Gentile Poles are also in the concentration camps on Polish soil and elsewhere. And we have to be careful, of course, with this phrase, you know, this idea of the concentration camps in any way being Polish, because they're not run by Poles. They are inhabited by unfortunate Poles, but they're certainly not run by them.
So, Roger Morehouse, as we mark 80 years since the invasion of Poland and the start of World War II in 1939, as you know, President Trump canceled his trip to Poland to stay back as a hurricane was bearing down on the United States. Mm-hmm. But how does World War II resonate in Poland today? What would he have seen if he had gone to Poland for the visit?
It's really front center in Poland's sense of itself, its national identity, its sense of sort of commemoration of its own suffering. Poland has a really sort of fascinating and rich but very, very difficult history, really. Of course, World War II, you've got this massive sort of sacrifice in World War II. One in five of the population are killed in World War II. They have the highest per capita death toll of any nation in World War II, which is an astonishing fact. So something like between 5 and 6 million people are killed. There's no family in Poland that is unaffected by this sort of thing. You know, they all have this in the locker, as it were. And then, of course, the war finishes and Poland is then, you know, as the quirk of history would have it, it is doomed to 40 years of communism.
Behind the Iron Curtain.
Behind the Iron Curtain until communism falls in 1989. So, you know, as I say, Poland's modern history is not short on horrors, but World War II really sort of caps the lot. It is the biggest horror of all. And it's one that I think the Poles rightly perceive that the outside world doesn't quite understand well enough. I think we all have, you know, our own sort of rather parochial views of history, in where we put our own suffering, our own actions very much to the forefront. And I think it would probably be a good idea for many of us to maybe extend that and try and look a little bit further beyond the horizon. I think really Poland, in terms of the war in Europe, I think Poland's experience is hideously typical. That's the real war in Europe, is one of ethnic cleansing, concentration camps, genocides, targeting of civilians, all of that stuff. That to me is World War II in Europe. And actually the sort of European or the Western European experience, which is a much more chivalrous war, really, it's very much at odds with that. And I think we have to sort of change our perspective somewhat. And I think that chimes with this perennial Polish idea that they think that the outside world doesn't really understand them.
Interesting, though, that today Poland is part of the European Union, along with Germany, and is extremely skeptical of Russia.
Yes. I mean, you know, Poland's found a very welcome home in the European Union, and you can understand, given that history, why they feel so comfortable in the European Union. That's surely obvious. And I mean, importantly, we saw it again at the weekend with the commemorations of the outbreak of the war, that the German president, Mr. Steinmeier, was very voluble in expressing his sense of guilt and all the rest of it for the actions of his forebears and his nation's forebears. And that's very welcome in Poland. But, you know, you look to the other side, there's no contrition on the Russian side for, you know, the actions of their forebears in 1939. As we said, you know, the Soviet Union Red Army invaded Poland as well,
right,
as an aggressor in 1939. But that doesn't fit the Russian narrative of the war. The Russian narrative of the war still today is one of solely of victimhood. You know, we were the victims after 1941. Interestingly, the only chronology they give for World War II is from 1941 to 45. They don't talk about the earlier 2 years, because that's the period in which they were the aggressors against their neighbors in as I said, cooperation with Hitler. So there's a very sort of skewed narrative of the war in modern day Russia. And that becomes problematical for Poland because, as I say, there's no sense of contrition, there's no apology. If anything, it's the opposite in the Russian case. And that's what explains why Mr. Putin, for example, wasn't invited to those commemorations, is because of that rather more aggressive shift in the Russian narrative, which we've seen in the last 10 years.
That is Roger Morehouse, who's got a new book out called First to Fight: The Polish War, 1939, Germany Invaded Poland 80 Years Ago This Week. Roger Morehouse, thank you.
My pleasure.
And you can see some photos of the German invasion of Poland at hereandnow.org.
Dorian is now a Category 1 hurricane as it continues to move up the East Coast. Strong winds and heavy rains have knocked out power to hundreds of thousands of people in the Carolinas and Virginia. Meanwhile, we're still getting a sense of the destruction in the Bahamas. The death toll has risen to at least 30, and that number is expected to climb. In Atlanta, Georgia, a tight-knit community of people with ties to the island nation are now grieving. For member station WABE, Sam Whitehead reports.
It's late morning, and Melissa Bevan sits outside an office building in the Atlanta suburbs. She's on the phone with her mother, who's hundreds of miles away in the Bahamas.
Mommy, I need you to get out of there.
Just a few days have passed since Hurricane Dorian parked over the islands, wreaking havoc on the natural and man-made landscape. Bevan says her mother is okay, even though her house flooded. Now, she just wants her to come to the States as soon as possible.
Mommy, I just need you out of there with all of the stuff going on. Just come and take a break until the way is clear. Can you do that for me, please?
It's been a hard time for Atlanta's Bahamian community, Bevan's included. She went about 24 hours without talking to her mother as Dorian's high winds and storm surge battered Grand Bahama. And she still hasn't heard from more distant relatives, uncles and cousins, who live all over the island.
I have family from East End to West End. That is the birth home of all of my ancestors. So in every part of that island, I've been impacted.
Outside a coffee shop across town, Blair Johnson says it's felt unreal watching the place where she grew up torn apart by a hurricane. She came to Atlanta in 2014, but is originally from Green Turtle Key, just off the Abaco Islands, where Dorian came ashore as a Category 5 storm.
I've never been so glued to my phone and just waiting for good news. I think I'm still in shock and still just waiting for someone to say this hasn't happened.
Johnson says she's doing what she can to help with the relief effort, donating money, sharing links to crowdfunding campaigns on social media. Still, she feels guilty about not being in the Bahamas in person. Right now, Johnson just wants to be home.
I would do anything to be over there and help my family right now. It's, the need is indescribable.
Elsewhere in town, people are doing what they can to help those in the Bahamas whose lives were torn apart by Dorian. Imani Scope wheels a cart full of supplies into the front lobby of an office building. Upstairs is the Atlanta office of the Bahamas Consulate General.
So I brought in some toiletries, toothpaste, toothbrushes, some non-perishables, so some pasta, some canned goods, you know, just a little bit that I could.
Scope doesn't have any connections to the islands, but he saw on social media that the council's office was taking donations and felt like stepping up.
My mom always told me, to whom much is given, much is expected, and required even. And when things like this happen, I try to give as much as I can.
And Scope isn't alone. An official with the council's office says they've already found a storage unit to accommodate all the expected donations, which they hope to start sending to the Bahamas next week. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
The latest jobs report out today from the Labor Department shows continued job growth, but the pace of that growth is slowing. The U.S. added 130,000 jobs in August, less than economists were expecting. About 20% of those gains were driven by all the temporary jobs that the federal government is creating for the 2020 census. For more, let's bring in Charisse Jones of USA Today. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
And what do you take away from this jobs report?
Well, you know, it's a really mixed bag. I mean, clearly wages are up. The unemployment rate is still near a 50-year low. The work week's gotten a little bit longer. But business people are very nervous. You know, the economies in some other countries overseas is really rocky. We've got this trade battle going on with China. And so they're hiring less and they're spending less.
Well, and in fact, these numbers from the Labor Department often get revised in one way or the other later. And in fact, earlier this month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics revised down the number of jobs we thought we'd gained since 2018 by 500,000. Should we be taking today's numbers with a grain of salt?
Yeah, a grain of salt is definitely in order, but we might actually see the numbers go in the other direction. With the August report, they often undercount the jobs because of seasonal positions and that type of thing. And so we tend to see them go up in the months that follow. So it remains to be seen if that's the case this time, but that's certainly been the pattern.
We did hear from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, today, who gave a speech and said that the Fed has, throughout the course of the year, seen fit to lower the interest rate path. But he says he's still got a favorable outlook for the economy. Tell us more about what the Fed had to say and what you think he's thinking as he considers whether to cut interest rates again.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying that a recession is probably not likely, and they feel that the indicators are still pretty positive. But you have a lot of economists who are saying that given all of the uncertainty that's kind of hanging over the horizon, there's still a good chance they'll probably wind up cutting it at least a quarter point. I mean, some folks want something a little bit deeper. It may not be very severe, but it's still very likely that that's the direction they're going to take.
You cover the retail industry very closely. How did it fare in August in the jobs report?
Not well at all. They cut about 11,000 jobs. And some of that is the concern about this battle with China and their sourcing and products going up in price. But a lot of it is just this long-term trend of people shifting to shopping online and brick-and-mortar retailers still trying to figure out how to survive in this new climate.
Do we have a sense at this point of whether the tariffs are actually affecting hiring yet?
Well, it's not looking good for the manufacturing industry. They basically added 3,000 jobs, which is incredibly anemic. And so I think it's fair to say that there are certainly some industries like retail, like manufacturing, that are getting very nervous. And we just had a new tariff hike go into effect this past weekend, and there's more on the horizon. And so people are not feeling very confident right now. They're jittery.
That is Charisse Jones, who covers business for USA Today. Charisse, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, in eastern Kentucky, it's been nearly 6 weeks since miners blocked a train hauling coal for a company that they say owes them thousands of dollars each in back pay. Black Jewel LLC declared bankruptcy in July. Some miners learned in the middle of their shifts that they were out of a job. Their pay was cut off, and they began to notice paychecks for previous work had bounced. That's when some miners decided to camp out on the train tracks outside the Clover Lick No. 3 mine in Harlan County, Kentucky. And their impromptu railroad blockade has grown into a protest movement with slogans like "No Pay, No Coal." One of those miners, formerly employed by Black Jewel, joins me now. Blake Watts, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And it's been almost 6 weeks since you helped establish this camp of coal miners there in Cumberland, Kentucky. Tell us about what it looks like there. What is the scene like at the camp?
Well, there's still a lot of miners down here, and we're all just camping out and keeping the tracks held down. You know, we got tents held up here, and we got, you know, people are bringing in food for us to keep us alive, and we're just trying to keep everything going.
And take us back to when it happened, when Black Jewel declared bankruptcy on July 1st. How did you find out you were out of a job?
Well, actually, see, I was on third shift, and I was actually getting ready. It was about 9:30 at night. It was on July 1st, and my buddy was coming out of the mines. He was on second shift, and he called me at 9:30, and he doesn't get out until around midnight. And he called me and told me they just told him to get out of the mines, that they just went bankrupt. So that's how I first found out.
And then where did the idea for the blockade come from?
Well, we actually, you know, just another normal day, and then we didn't hear anything. And what happened was that they actually was using a front loader to push the train cars into the loading yard. That way they wouldn't fire up the train and alert everyone, you know, they was loading coal and stealing it. And then after they loaded the train, they actually fired the train up to take it out. And that's what we heard, was the final cars being loaded before they took it out.
And lawyers representing the miners in bankruptcy proceedings say the former Black Jewel employees are owed more than $4,000 each. How much money are you owed? How much have you lost as a result of this?
I'm still owed about $6,000 is what they still owe me. Plus, they owe me severance pay. Most of the miners are even owed up to, you know, $6,000 and $7,000, and even more.
And what kind of impact has that had on your life to not have that money?
It's affecting me by being able for me to pay my bills and even, you know, buy my little girl things. It's made it tighter and a struggle on just daily living, really.
Now, you were able to find a new mining job in Harlan County, right?
Actually, it's in Virginia. It's about a 45-minute drive from my house.
Mm-hmm. What about your friends and former colleagues there in Harlan County? Have they been able to find new work?
Two of my friends actually went to Alabama to work for Warrior Met Coal. A lot of my friends are doing, you know, odd jobs, cleaning cars, painting houses, mowing yards, stuff like that, just to keep alive until they hear something from the mines, and just kind of waiting it out.
Do you think you're going to get the money back from Black Jewel?
It's tough to say, and the longevity that we've been waiting, it's more like a cat and mouse game. We're just sitting here waiting and waiting, and we never seem to really get the answer.
Now, as you know, politicians have gotten involved in this. Bernie Sanders sent pizzas. Kentucky's Republican Governor Matt Bevin and Amy McGrath, who's the Democratic candidate going up against Mitch McConnell for his Senate seat, have also shown up. What do you think about the political support you've gotten?
It's honestly been very crazy because it's helped boost the awareness of what we're doing and what we're trying to do. We're not trying to do this for fame. We're not trying to do this for really a political standpoint, but we're just trying to make it to where we all get paid. That's what we went underground for to grind that coal, was to get paid. But it has been a huge impact on us getting somewhere to get our money, was for them joining in.
Do you think President Trump should weigh in?
It would help out a whole lot more if he did, but I feel like at the same time, people would bring it to a different standpoint that it would be strongly evolved around politics and other than what it is, just the coal miner versus the businessman.
Now, this protest that you've been involved in was spontaneous, but there is a history of labor organizing in Harlan County, Kentucky, where you are. Labor disputes between miners and coal companies turned violent in both the 1930s and the 1970s. Do you feel any connection to that history?
Well, we've talked about that a lot, about old Bloody Harlan. And we've, you know, we didn't have any intentions of it going that way, which is still not. people keep asking us if it's just history repeating itself, and it is, but this way it's a little different. We've actually made contacts with people instead of just showing up, you know, causing violence. We've actually just peacefully approached people.
Has this whole episode made you reconsider anything about the coal industry or the economic future for this part of Kentucky?
It's made me realize that, you know, you need to look into things, especially with coal mining, because it's up and down. It's always, you just never know. But the companies that invest into multiple properties who don't have the money to do so is what really fails and files bankruptcy.
Now, this could come to a resolution soon, but how long are you willing to keep this protest going?
Until we get paid. That's been the standpoint from the start.
That is Blake Watts, a coal miner in Harlan County, Kentucky. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
And we reached out to Black Jewel for comment. They sent a statement from the company's interim CEO, Dave Beckman, that reads in part, "Black Jewel knows that each day that passes creates additional hardship for miners who have not yet been brought back to work and their families. The company is doing everything possible to accelerate the process of getting the employees back to work and continues to work tirelessly on finding ways to make all of the employees whole on their pre-petition wages." We'll continue to follow this story here and now.
There's a new warning today from the CDC. People should consider stopping the use of e-cigarettes while the agency investigates a soaring number of serious lung injuries. The Indiana Health Department said today that a third person has died of the vaping-related illness, which has now affected more than 400 people across the country. Also, the FDA says it has new evidence that vitamin E in vaping products could be to blame. Joining us now is Dr. Jonae Khaldoun. She's chief medical executive for the state of Michigan, which became the first state to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarette products this week after she declared youth vaping a public health emergency. Doctor, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks. And how promising is this lead that vitamin E found in these cannabis samples may be causing the vaping injuries we've seen across the country?
Yes, that certainly is something that's very interesting. It's something that's new. I know the FDA is looking at this, and it certainly merits more investigation. But what we know is that there are chemicals in these vaping products, and sometimes we don't know what they are, but they are certainly concerning and something that we need to be looking more at.
What questions do you still have about the origins of these injuries?
We don't know what exactly the chemicals are that are in these vaping products. We don't know if there's things related to timing. We don't know if it's the actual chemical or if it's something related to the vaping apparatus. There's a lot of questions that I still have about what these injuries are being caused by.
Well, your boss, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, announced this week that sales of flavored e-cigarettes will be banned in Michigan. So that means flavors like bubblegum, cotton candy, no longer will be allowed. What's the science that backs that up?
I declared in the state a public health emergency, specifically because of the use of youth e-cigarettes. We know over the past few years that many counties actually across the state of Michigan have seen more than a doubling of the number of youth that are using e-cigarettes. We know that most of them start with a flavor, and of course we know the nicotine particularly leads to addiction and longer-term health problems. And then, as we've discussed over the past several weeks, we've seen these hospitalizations, over 200 of them across the country, and six they were investigating in Michigan. Sometimes when you see the data, you see the science, and you have to move quickly and make bold action to protect the public's health, and that's what our governor is doing.
But your critics will say that the governor is taking away an adult's right to choose. We let adults purchase flavored alcohol, tobacco products, things like that. We know those products are also dangerous.
From a public health perspective, it's all about protecting the public's health and protecting the youth, particularly in our state. We still are allowing vaping products to be marketed. You just will not be able to get bubble gum. And I also will say that the data about the safety of these vaping products, it's particularly long term, is not really clear yet. So, of course, I know that a lot of adults are switching from cigarettes to vaping products, and I absolutely support anyone who wants to quit smoking. But we still need to look at the data longer term on these vaping products overall.
Well, isn't that a reason? The fact that the long term impact of these devices is still unclear, isn't that a reason to wait until you have more information before making such a ban?
Well, as we know in public health, sometimes you can't wait 20 years for all the data to come in. You have to move quickly. We have people across the country who are in the hospital. We have people who have died. This is an emergency. I talk to moms all the time who are concerned about their high school or even their middle schoolers who are vaping and they don't know what to do about it. We know that companies are targeting youth specifically with their advertising. So, again, sometimes you have to act quickly when there's an emergency. I'm an emergency medicine physician as well. You don't always have all the data and perfect data, but this is something that we thought was very important and appropriate.
How do you weigh those risks, the fact that people are currently injured because of these devices, with the fact that many people say these devices help them stop smoking and that, you know, with a ban, they may have to go back to smoking cigarettes?
And again, for this particular emergency rule that we are moving forward with, we are not banning vaping altogether. We are particularly banning the flavors. So e-cigarettes will still be available for adults who want to use them.
And the ban will last for 6 months while more research is done. It's a pretty short window of time. What do you think will happen next? Will this become permanent in Michigan?
Our emergency rules, once they go into effect, they'll be in effect for 180 days, and after that we can extend them for up to an additional 6 months. And in the meantime, we'll be working with our partners to look at the data, to evaluate, and to move forward with permanent rules.
So you're banning flavored e-cigarettes, but are you worried that kids will just decide to go to the standard e-cigarettes?
We know that, according to recent research, that 81% of youth e-cigarette users start with a flavored e-cigarette first. Part of our rules as well will also talk about advertising, fraudulent and misleading statements, making sure that no one is advertising around candy and soft drinks. So it's about the flavors, but it's also about just the advertising arena and how these companies are advertising to our youth as well.
That's Dr. Jonae Khaldoun. She's chief medical executive with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Doctor, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.